training.
I know. I want to go see my doctor.
Assuming you're all here, of course, you got the email, you signed up for the course, and you applied, but you got the email, so I know that I've got it going on my email distribution. So, let me make sure I know where everyone is. Andrew. But Andrew, Ashley. David? David Chang 2? David Chang 1? That was David. He's in though, right? Okay. Dawn. Deborah. Diana. Jessica. We're down to one. That would be you, Jerkow, right? Melanie. Rosita. That's right. Rosita.
Yeah.
Paige. Robert. How do you get an email? Did you get my email? He didn't reply. Failure to follow instructions. Okay, what you got? Ronald. Surad. He didn't reply either.
No.
But you got the email. Dana. Schumann. And Tanya. All right, that's like 18 people I almost passed through. Kinetics. Take a deep breath. It's not that difficult. I don't know what you've been hearing, but I've been hearing a lot directly from you or from other people who have heard from you, and you're in a panic. And there's no reason for you to panic. Okay? It's intuitively obvious, it's logical, it's elegant, it makes sense. What you need to do is pay attention, follow along, ask questions when you don't understand things, read the book, read the handouts, it should be fine. That being said, the other thing we're going to ask you to do in this course, which you may not have been asked to do previously, is actually use your 2 years. I'm going to ask you to think. I ask you to take what you're learning and do something with it, other than just telling us what you heard. Okay? Because being in graduate school, learning how to be a scientist means that you're learning how to think. You're learning how to ask questions, you're learning how to find answers, interpret data. So this course is going to be a first step, we hope, in getting you on that path. And I don't care whether any of you want to go into working with bacteria at all, that's not the point. Both prokaryotic and eukaryotic studies is genetics. It's also a foundation for a lot of what you're going to be doing. Whether you're going to be doing anything with bacteria, doing anything with genetics, whether you're going to work with viruses, working with immunology, a lot of it still comes down to understanding how genetics works. Okay? So I don't want you to get the idea either that we're doing what we're doing here. Giving another food to go to. I hope none of you are coming in here with that attitude, particularly since people are just trying to scare the devil out of you about the whole course. Okay? Take it for what its purpose is. It's a discipline that's required for you to be a better scientist. It's also a discipline which is going to teach you how to think. And it's going to give you a foundation for a lot of the other stuff that you're going to go into, whether you go off on a genetics track or another track in molecular biology or emerging infectious diseases. And that's the most part of the book. Okay? Now, the first assignment was basically, if you haven't already guessed it, it's to review. All I want to do is make sure that you understand where we're going to be starting, which means that we have gone over the med micro mini block in genetics and bacterial physiology that we gave you, because that's really what I'm going to assume that you all know. Now, there's a certain number of you also who have taken genetics as undergraduates. Raise your hand. like almost everybody, right? It's been part of the game, right? So again, some of the things we're asked to do is basically go to the introductory chapter of this book. Everyone got a copy of this book? Right? Yes? No? You got a copy?
I have a book. Thank you.
Right now? Are they working on the news? Okay. But you have the fine edition to it? That's good enough for starting. I looked through it and there are not a lot of changes, but they should give you a copy of this. Okay, everyone else has a copy of the next one, guys.
Oh,
I'm
supposed to get
textbooks
on the
girls
at what?
I don't know if they can talk.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad I don't get it.
Yeah. Okay, well, Jessica, high school, I think, is going to be going to the class this year. So I'm going to talk to her.
Okay.
Is she here? Okay. Yeah. All right. So, review of the Med Micro, read the textbook and the readings as we go throughout the course, okay? The other thing which I think is really, really very useful, and I've seen this over the years as well, is that no matter what discipline in the sciences you follow, each one of them has its own contribution. And a lot of people get hung up because they don't understand the terms. If you spend a little bit of time looking things up, there's a very nice glossary at the back of your textbook, which has a lot of the terms, a nice pocket description of these terms. So when you've got people like myself or other lecturers and you're up there and talk to them, they're going to use terminology you may not be familiar with. But after they're slipping the jargon and don't explain what the terms mean, don't get panicked, don't get lost, raise your hand, ask the question, and look it up. You're reading the textbook ahead of time. You're going across terms you're going to understand. Look it up. It doesn't cost anything. It really will educate you because the language is part of doing science. It's a shorthand for doing science. And there's no reason, there's no excuse to be lost just because you don't understand what you're doing over there. So spend some time looking up the terms if you really need to. Okay? Alright. Basic definitions. And again, this goes into a little bit of review of what we did in that line. Genotype and phenotype. What's the difference between genotype and phenotype? So the genotype in any organism, let's speak of genotype. Yes?
I didn't get
happy with the
like, genotype.
Genotype is the genetic constitution of an organism. It's the gene. It's really the molecular description of the organism. The phenotype is what we see. It's the observable properties of the organism. It's based on the genotype, but it's not equivalent to the genotype. Okay? Now I'm going to ask you why that is.
Not all
the genes are coding genes? That's part of the reason, but it's not only. Yeah. Well, I don't know if that computer back here.
No.
No. Andrew?
I did not hear.
You didn't hear.
Environmental factors.
Did you hear that?
Yes.
Do you know what he said?
He said environmental factors.
Does that mean anything to you?
No.
Now, I'm not going to pick on you. I guess I am going to pick on you. I'm going to pick on everyone because what you need to do is speak precisely. Part of science is communication. If you can't communicate your thoughts clearly, you're not going to be very good as a scientist, but no one can understand what you're talking about. So when you give answers, develop those answers. If you were to ask like this, doesn't really answer that question, doesn't it?
No.
Didn't answer a few, and I'm sure everyone else in here is just nodding their head saying, I'm on all facts. I don't know what that means, but might be the answer. So what do you exactly mean by an all facts?
That's
No. No. Andrew?
No.
Oh.
Yes.
Tamison.
Tamison. What did you say?
You said,
You can hear it.
You can just say, it doesn't matter what you said, I didn't understand what you meant.
Yeah, well, I understood it, and then I forgot it. I was trying to write it down.
Yeah, I don't know if I needed to mention this at the beginning of the course, but, you know, whatever you learn in the course class, the rest of the year, it's maybe beyond. Okay, so you're on the right track. What am I getting at here? Somebody else? Okay, select the pressure. Andrew, how many words is that?
Two.
Is that any more than the environmental factors?
No.
Okay, so we're not getting real precise here.
What if you, if there was a mutation that was suppressed by another mutation, so that the phenotype appeared wild type, but the genotype was actually mutant?
Okay, there's an example. Right. All right. Now, getting back to environmental factors. What do you really need to say there?
Bacteria or
bread
that has higher temperatures,
so
just the
environment
turn on or turn off.
That's what we're looking for, okay? Gene regulation. Gene regulation is going to dictate whether or not you can see what the genotype is. Because if the gene is regulated in such a fashion by environmental factors, for example, so that the genes are not expressed, phenotypically, it'll look like they don't have that property. Okay? If you hit upon the right conditions for the gene to be expressed, then you can guess that, okay, it has a genotype which is reflective of that particular property. So the simple case is black alkaline. E. coli expresses genes that allow it to utilize lactose. Those genes are in the black alkaline. So if you were to grow the organism on rich medium with glucose as a carbon source, would you be able to tell whether or not the organism is capable of using lactose? No. Because it preferentially uses glucose as a carbon source, even in intestinal vacuums. So if you're putting it on an indicator plate, which would, let's just use X-GAP. Everyone knows what X-GAP is, right?
No.
Who doesn't know what X-GAP is? Who knows what X-GAP is? Dana?
You don't know what X-GAP is?
Come on, be daring. Be daring. Anybody. Go ahead, explain what XGAP is.
XGAP is a way to select these sugars which say the crops can turn whiter easily based on what their altitude is
expressed. Okay, do you want to understand that?
How is it spelled?
Letter X, GAL.
Oh.
Clear? Everyone? Remarkable because it was really not
pretty. It wasn't very specific at all.
Okay, XGAL, and we'll talk about this a little bit later. I just want to get a little bit ahead. XGAL is a colorless compound, which is derived from beta-galactoside. Beta-galactosidase, which is the product of the Lac-Z gene, which cleaves lactose to produce glucose and galactose, so the bacteria can use it for growth. Right, that's what beta-galactosidase is. Basically, XGAL is a derivative of the sugar, which is colorless. But it's hooked to a indigo dye, which, when it's cleaved, releases a blue color. So that's where you get your classic blue-white screening, and you can clone it. So a lot of the cloning vectors involve going into the Lac-Z gene. So if you put a piece of DNA in there, it inactivates the gene, thus can't produce the enzyme, thus the bacteria won't be able to produce the enzyme on the indicator plate. So those colonies will be white colonies that still have the active gene with the active enzyme you produce. You cleave the colorless compound to produce blue colonies, which means those aren't going to be. Okay, so on an indicator plate, you can tell whether or not bacteria can utilize different sugar compounds. In this case, it's lactose, which is the X-GAL. So if you have an indicator like X-GAL in medium as glucose in, and you're saying, okay, well, let's see if the bacteria can utilize lactose, and thus has lactose as a function, because the glucose is present, gene repression of the expression of black alkaline, all the polymers of white, your conclusion might be black alkaline is inactivated. But that's not the genotype because gene expression, the repression of the alkaline because of the glucose gives you a phenotype that looks like it's black negative. Whereas if you put it under condition for you to get expression of the genes, then you would say, well, the genotype is in fact wild type because of these functional. So this is basically a synopsis of why phenotype depends on the genes. It all depends on gene expression. Okay? Now, part of the language means that when we're talking about bacteria, and for the most part we're talking about E. coli, because E. coli really is the workhorse for bacterial genetics. It is the basis for a lot of what we know about prokaryotic genetics. Genes are described using a particular nomenclature. And in fact, the nomenclature which was established by Demarest and his colleagues in the early 60s to describe the genes in E. coli has been used for describing genes in yeast as well and some other higher organisms. So it's a very robust, very useful type of way for naming genes. And it starts out with a distinction between phenotype and the genotype. So whenever we refer to a phenotype, we use non-italicized characters. Genotypes, it defines the actual gene, uses italicized characters. And the allele description that Demarest and colleagues instituted is based on three letters for the designation of a gene. And in the case of a phenotype, it was non-italicized. The first letter is an uppercase, so talking about lactose utilization, it would be abbreviated lac. Again, a lot of these things are in two. Some of them are not going to be in two. But a lot of them are. So for the ability or inability to utilize lactose as a carbon source, lac. In combination genes, how do you think they might be abbreviated for a phenotype? It's intuitive, okay? Ability to utilize arabinase would be abbreviated ARA, okay? So we're talking about the genotype, we're talking about the actual genes that are involved. So again, using a three-letter code, three-letter designation, italicized, all in lowercase. And the more you know about a particular pathway, then the more letters you may need to add to the system. So for the lac operon, we start out with understanding how lactose is utilized, it turns out that there are three genes in the operon. So in order to distinguish each of these genes separately, we add a fourth character, which is uppercase letter. And in the case of the lac operon, it was just ZYA. The reason for that being, I'm not exactly sure why, but that's just the reason, that's just the designation they gave the three genes in the operon. The first gene being beta-galactosidase, Z gene, black-white the permease, and A being subtilis. So the fourth character then, in fourth place is uppercase. That defines specifically a gene. So when you're talking about characterizing pathway initiatives, for example, well, let's say they started out like Jacobi Monod did in the early 1960s and they just got mutants that were unable to utilize lactose. So you just start calling all those mutants LAC 100, LAC 105, LAC 1015, numbering the mutants until you have a more defined description of how many genes are actually involved. So it may turn out that the first five mutants that you got, LAC mutants 1 through 5, are all mutations in the LAC gene. So you then change the nomenclature and the designation of those mutants to LAC Z, 1, like Z2, like Z3. Those are all mutations in the same gene, but they're different alleles, different mutant isolations. So like Z1 may be a mutation that affects the fifth codon. Like Z5 may be a mutation that affects the 29th codon. Same gene, different allele. Okay? So now you know a little bit about the definition of genes and alleles. Alleles are just different variants of the same gene. So the LAC Z gene, once you start isolating mutants in it, you started isolating alleles of that particular gene, mutant alleles of that protein. Okay? Now, if we're talking about a regular wild-type genotype, we use an uppercase, or a superscript positive. We use a superscript positive also for the wild-type phenotype. And by definition, if you indicate a particular genotype, that means that you're looking at the mutant allele of that gene. So the convention is, if you don't indicate in genotype of an organism any particular gene, right, any particular genotype for a locus, that means it's wild type. So the default is it's wild type unless it's said otherwise. Thus, when you're looking at genes which are described like here, you'll be looking at mutant alleles and not the wild type alleles. So it's understood that unless there is a superscript positive, that these are actually negative alleles. So when you're looking at the independent mutations in a particular gene, just as we talked about for the last Z gene, here the example I'm using is this C gene. This is one of the enzymes in the pathway to synthesize histidine. This is allele number 567 in that particular gene, the gene for this enzyme, the C gene. So there's independent mutations in numbered serial. And this is important because when you start looking at genotypes of bacterial strains, and if you pick up any issue of your whole bacteriology or infection community, and you look at the strain tables, you'll have genotypes of the strains. And a good geneticist will indicate, the complete genotype will sort of indicate where the known mutations are in the different genes in that organism. So if there's nothing indicated for histidine metabolism, then it's understood that the phenotype and the genotype is wild type. There are no mutations. Similarly, if you see under the genotype of the organism, nothing indicated about a black operon, and it's understood that it is wild type for the utilization of lactose. So that's the general convention then for listing genotypes. What is listed are the altered or the mutated alleles of the organism. Now, this also means that you need to know something about the organism that you're working with to begin with. Okay? Because if you're talking about wild type versus mutant, then that sort of presupposes that you have a reference strain, which is your wild type strain, a strain which has been mutations. And all of the different organisms which are used for genetic analysis have a reference strain. And all of these strains have been sequenced now, so you can have the reference strain down to the base pair level. Keep in mind also when you start changing E. coli to some of these other systems, that what's present in E. coli may not be present in other organisms. So certain properties of E. coli may not be present in Salmonella. Now, does that mean the Salmonella is mutated for those genes? Not necessarily. It may just be that Salmonella doesn't have those genes. And you can't directly compare to E. coli as a reference strain. You need to compare Salmonella to a Salmonella reference strain. Okay, so know what your reference strain is, what you're comparing. Other characters and allele descriptions include whether your organism is sensitive or resistant to different compounds, superscript S for R, and subscripts such as AM, AMBER, that defines whether a particular point mutation creates an AMBER stop code, a nonsense mutation. Other characterizations such as TS for temperature-sensitive mutants. The temperature-sensitive mutants are mutations in genes which inactivates the gene product when the organism is running a certain type of temperature. So phenotypically, the organism has no function for that gene when growing at the non-permissive temperature. Phenotypically, it looks wild type when growing at the permissive temperature. Because the mutation, again, is the difference between phenotype and genotype. The mutation alters the gene such that the protein is now sensitive to temperature in terms of its functionality. At the other end of the spectrum, cold sensitive mutants are analogous, but they are inactive or have reduced activity at lower temperature. When we're talking about TS mutants in E. coli, generally E. coli is going at 37 degrees. Temperature sensitive mutants they show their phenotype at temperatures above 37, generally 40, 42 degrees. Cold sensitive mutants get down around 30 degrees. The rest of it is self-evident, I think. Deletions are important. You'll see a lot of examples of trans types of deletions. That's just uses the Greek delta. And a double colon is to indicate there's an insertion of a piece of DNA within a gene. And generally, these insertions will inactivate the gene or create gene fusions. And we'll be talking about those later on. Now, in terms of understanding the genes themselves and the language of the alleles, you can look at the E. coli linkage map in its print copy, which is available and it's now 10 years old. This has been updated online. You can also look at the description of the genes in the E. coli Salmonella Bible, which is available for ASM Press. And the handout I gave you a list of some other references to find in the LRC. A lot of these things are easy to find online as well if you know where to look. So I'll just give you a couple of indications of where to look, such as the Colibri website. There's even a Wikipedia-inspired E. coli website called E. coli Wiki, which has entry points for going in and looking at specific genes in E. coli. The Colibri site, which is on a server at Institut Pasteur, has all of the genes in a searchable format with linkages to different analysis packages for looking at the different genes. The reason why I'm giving you these two websites is just as an entry point so that you can look and explore. My goal here is to give you a way to look at genes or to look up genes and find out what they encode. So if I talk about HIS-C, like I did on the previous slide, you're thinking, okay, I know it's important for histidine metabolism, but I don't know what it actually encodes. Well, I don't remember either, but I know where to look it up. So you can go to either one of these websites, type in HIS-C, and it'll pull down the gene for you. It'll give you a description of the gene product that encodes, what's known about regulation, it'll give you the DNA sequence, the translated protein sequence. You can do blast searches on it, look at comparisons to other genes and other organisms, or homologs of that particular gene. You get the picture, right? This is a way of understanding a little bit more about the genes that we've talked about for the past. Similarly, if you want to know more about the genes that are in the recombination pathway, you can just go to either one of these websites and type in REC, start with REC A, go to REC D, B, C, you can find out what all those different genes encode. So basically, it's a reference point. And understanding how to find these things on the internet is better than Googling, because it'll cut through all the crap and fall off and start doing it. Okay, now, one of the first things I like to do is to go back and make sure that we're all up to date on what we know about molecular biology and genetics before we actually start the course. So, I gave you the reading assignment to look through the first two chapters of the book, the introductory chapters. And some of the things that we got in there, I want to talk about now to be sure that you all understand. So, this experiment is the Nestleson Skull experiment. Now the slide's up here, and that you all read it, I just want someone to explain it to everybody. I'm sure that we all understand.
It was to show, this is the one that shows semi-conservative replication of DNA.
Is that a question?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm pretty sure it is. So.
And they agree. Okay, yeah, it is.
So they had the DNA for E. coli, and they were able to put it in a tube with heavy, it's like an isotope.
Not like an isotope, but actually it is an isotope.
I don't know of what it was, though.
Nitrogen.
So that would incorporate into the DNA the deoxynucleotide. And it would be, if it was double, the original wouldn't have the heavy chain, so if it replicated and it incorporated the heavy chains into a semi-conservative, then half of it would be heavy and half of it would be light. And if both of them incorporated into it and kept the light chains with the original chains being separate instead of semi-conservative, and it just had a new one with the heavy chains, and that would be heavier. So it would have three different levels depending on what the how they replicated. So they put it in a centrifuge.
Okay, so stop right there.
Okay.
Anybody want to add anything or clarify anything or ask questions?
Weren't the original, all of the original strain and both strands during the original sample, both strains were radiolabeled with the 15N isotope.
Right. We have to start out with they're grown in heavy medium, so all the DNA, both strains, are labeled with the heavy isotope. So you just kind of skip the step, which is really like, right? Okay, one pick up from the other?
And then after, so the original DNA was labeled with the heavy isotope. And when it was switched over to a medium, it contained the regular nitrogen.
Right.
And
so it's the light isotope or the normal.
And allowed to go for several generations. When they ran it through an ultra centrifuge that was using a density gradient, so.
Okay, so that's what this is, right? Everyone know what that is, cesium chloride? Density gradient? Twice that could be an issue. Okay. There's density gradient.
And then they could look at the density gradient to determine, like Paige was saying, originally it was heavier, and then as the replication went on, since it was semi-conservative, there were fewer and fewer of the heavy strands incorporated into the.
Okay, so what's the prediction when we see?
We should see a density gradient with more and more.
Okay, good.
Samples.
Is there a marker on that one quarter there?
Yeah.
I want you to draw out what the expected result is. In fact, Paige, why don't you stand up there and ask people to help you to draw out what the expected result should be? Since you shouldn't have to carry the whole week. So after the first generation, we can draw some gradient there and then just ask people to tell you where to do what next. What's he going to put on there next? What's the results going to be after the one generation?
One band.
Okay, I could put that band anywhere in that tube, right?
Should be heavy.
Okay, so mark that. That's heavy, so that's 15N. 15, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you got one heavy band. That's it? The width is just one time point? This is the first sample? What are we looking at here?
We didn't compare them to the dorm.
What are we looking at here, Paige? Can I tell you? This is the parent. Okay? It's all heavy. Right. Okay. Let's go through one generation. Now what are we going to see on the gradient? No, they're going to help you out. Let's see
an equal amount of heavy and weight.
Okay, so where did that take? And that, how we're going to label that change?
We're
going to call it. Okay, so we're going to call that
item.
And a hybrid molecule is a mix of. What is it? What do you mean by heavy?
Heavy.
It's
heavy. One heavy and one light.
Two isotopes, mm-hmm. Heavy and light. Does that just mean that the two strands of DNA migrate at a hybrid place, or what?
Actually, half of the NTPs will come down, and half of the whole length protein, that's what also will go up. Because we are looking at hybrid and
so it's a hybrid molecule, meaning what?
So hybrid molecule, the concentration of N2 should go down, and the double bond concentration of N2 should go up.
Okay, so that one band that you're saying is going to diminish?
Right.
Okay. So if you had a thick band there, then you're going to end up with a thinner band of heavy N2. So we're talking about the hybrid molecules. We're talking about what precisely at the molecular level? Radioactivity in double-stranded DNA. The whole idea here is that semi-conservative replication, we think double-stranded DNA. So the hybrid molecules, you can abbreviate this, and I think I did on the figure, you got to start out with heavy, HH. First generation, get that band that's up there that's a little bit lighter, less dense, is what? HN. Okay? And that's what you would predict if it was represented by semi-conservative replication, right? To continue through the replication, what are we going to see? Another band? Where? Higher? And what would that band represent? N14? Just N14? Not attached to DNA? N14 labeled DNA in both strands. Okay? Because after the first round of replication, half three molecules, or your molecules will have one strand of heavy, one strand of light. The next round of replication is going to segregate out. Right? You're going to end up with light, light, and heavy light. Okay? Don't forget, there's always going to be some strand in there, a final strand, which is labeled heavy. That's still going to be in the population. Okay, that's good. So that was an experiment that was done by, I hesitate to say someone just like you, because I think he was a little bit older, but Frank Stahl was a graduate student when he did this experiment with Matt Messelson. He's a graduate student. This guy was really sharp. Still is really sharp. He's one of the best geneticists around. Just as an aside, how many of you have heard of Matt Messelson? And what context? This experiment? Anything else? Did you do something later?
No, I was thinking
of something that changes. No, I'm not thinking about that. I'm thinking about something which is different than the molecular biology. That's why I said it's an aside. Everybody? One time, one student actually answered the question and then got it. Of course, I don't know if they met him somewhere. But Matt Messelson, not only was he an outstanding molecular biologist, but he was very, very active in the nuclear disarmament movement in the 1970s. He was very vocal in terms of getting scientists together to try to come up with ways to stop nuclear proliferation. And also was involved in a lot of inspections of Russian weapons facilities and was involved, in fact, in the investigation on the so-called anthrax incident in the Soviet Union back in 1990. Some of you may be familiar with that. Okay. Matt Messelson is really quite an amazing individual. The reason why I kind of put these little stories out there and use names is because I want you all to get an appreciation for the field of science that you're getting into, okay? I'm sure that you've seen a zillion times on TV where some sports luminary of some sort talks about someone in the past who also has an environmental achievement in this sport. You as scientists need to know who the heroes are in a particular discipline. And we'll start now with molecular biology and genetics today. Okay, so I'd like you to know the names of some of the greats on the past, so you can appreciate what they did, not just because of what they did, but also the way that you become a better scientist is by studying how great minds think and how they develop their ideas and how they do experiments. That's why it's really useful to go through some of these experiments in a little bit of detail, talk about how they're done. Okay, another name that comes out of the reading that you did is Okazaki. You should remember this in the context of Okazaki fragments. So I want to ask you to tell me what an Okazaki fragment is and why it's important to understanding basic bacterial metabolism. I'm going to ask for the volunteer, otherwise Paige is going to pick up the volunteer.
I'm going
to say you're ready. An Okazaki fragment is on the lagging strand in DNA transcription, and it's a small chunk that's, I'm going to get the direction wrong, but if the DNA can't synthesize all in the one direction, and so it just does the small in the right direction, but it can only do a small chunk because the replication fork hasn't moved far enough along the strand of DNA.
Okay, let's stop right there. Let's just point out a couple of things. Number one, all right, first is,
replication, on transcription.
Yeah.
That's fine. I think you're thinking a little too fast for something. Second problem is, someone's got to define for me in scientific terms what you mean by chunk.
Isn't it 10 to 12 base pairs?
That's much better than a chunk.
Stretch.
Okay, this is what I'm getting at. Now, the directionality actually is very, really quite important. So I'm going to ask you to go up to the whiteboard here and to draw out a DNA replication fork and to show us where are the cyclic fragments coming in line of the So whenever you draw a double-stranded DNA, I would always indicate the 5'3" climax. As soon as you do that, your orientation is fixed and you will never go wrong. Of course, I wouldn't do it that way. 5'3" from the top to the left. There's 2 climax to the right, because that's just general dimension of the same plus. Both strands, indicate on both strands, 5'3" climax. Okay, now let's make out a fork. It shows how you replicate the complementary strand on each one of those single strands. Because this is where the oxide fragment comes in. First of all, who can tell us, the name again is Thomas. Who can tell Thomason what the directionality is for DNA forms? 5'3" to 3'. Drill that in your head. Synthesizes in a 5'3" direction. Now, you're going to make sure that you know where your 5'3" ends are, right? And you drew us synthesis of DNA in a 5'3" direction.
Mm-hmm. I did.
How many agree with that? Top strand is 5'3". And she's drawing us from 3' end to the 5' end, the complementary strand. Is that correct? Put a label on that end there. What end is that? The strand you just drew. Well, yeah, it's 5', right? It just told us it only can replicate in the 5'3" direction. And you can't change the orientation of the top strand. Since the strand you synthesize is in the wrong direction. Right? Everyone understand that? Who does?
I didn't see it. I could only see your back, I'm sorry.
Okay, Andrew, why don't you go up to the board there and draw us a replication for us. We'll get this straight down.
Okay.
This is important, guys. This is why I'm telling you, it's intuitive. If you think about it, it all makes sense. So draw us replication for. So you start out with your double-stranded DNA, turn it into a fork, and just label 5'3". Both strands. Okay, make it a fourth strand. Let's get a single strand. So where does the DNA polymerase start replicating and what's the product going to look like? If the DNA polymerase replicates in the 5'3" direction. Two different colors are open there? Okay. So use an alternate color to show us the newly synthesized strand.
So this is the
How is that being made?
In the opposite direction of the
Okay, so we take into consideration what we all just said about the orientation of synthesis by DNA polymerase. Show us the direction of the DNA polymerase is moving.
The direction of the polymerase is moving.
Right. But on the other string, using the synthesis, right?
Well,
that's so it's moving that direction. Okay? Now, draw us what's going to be happening on the other arm. The other single string.
So this is also functional.
It's still fine. Right.
Right. Then the new ones for reappearance. And this is the other doctor.
Yeah.
New ones for reappearance.
Well, that's, you've already synthesized the whole strand there.
Use the white side.
The bottom.
Yeah. What's happening on the single strand at the fork at the bottom?
You mean anything? This one?
Yeah.
Is it the Okazaki fragment? No, wait. This is the leading
strand, right? Is it? I don't know. You're asking me. I'm asking you. You can't do that.
Why can't I make it the leading strand?
Oh, you can. But do you want to be right?
Yeah, so then that's like, okay, so then this one's the leading strand. So then this should be in fragments.
All right, and why is it going to be in fragments? Those are the oversight of the part of it, right? Why is it going to be in fragments?
Because the DNA polymerase can only work in one direction.
All right. So it's a question of where does it start? So where does it start here? Starts at the bottom. Starts at the beginning of your fork there, right?
Oh.
What's happening on the other strand?
The other strand is going in one direction.
And show us the direction. Just put in arrow. Show us the direction. Draw a little circle of the DNA polymerase.
So it's reading in the
Don't it's synthesizing in which direction?
So it has to be synthesized in the same
It synthesizes in which direction the polymerase?
5'5"
5'5" 3'5" Synthesizes in the 5'5" 3'5" So you remember to turn that arrow. Right. Okay, so draw us a circle represent the polymerase on that strand. And as that starts to move in the 5' to 3' direction of synthesis, what's happening to the fork? Anyway. It's opening. So what's going to happen to the polymerase on that bottom strand? It just keeps going. It keeps going. That's why we call that the leading strand. It keeps going. There's nothing to stop it. Enzymatically speaking, there's nothing to stop it. It keeps going because it processes. It's a processive enzyme. Polymerases are processive enzymes. Polymerase, polymers, it keeps going. On the other strand, however, the reason why we have Okazaki fragments is because of the constraints of the replication flow. It can only, the polymerase can only start at some point and move in the other direction, away from the fork. It can't go back. That's why we call it a lagging strand, because the polymerase goes by fits and stops. Right? Thank you, Andrew. And this is what it looked like in the in your book. Basically, the same thing you sketched out there. There's nothing novel about what's in the book. You guys have the same form there. Because of the processivity of the polymerase on the reading strand, as it goes, it opens up replication flow. That's what drives the separation of the double strand. Okay? And each time you do that, you've got the single strand of DNA that's open, it serves as a template, but the DNA polymerase can't go backwards on it. So when the DNA polymerase starts here and goes forwards in the 5'3" direction of synthesis, it's going, and it's making a fragment. And behind it is empty space. then empty space is going to be filled in by a reinitiation or a new initiation of DNA polymerase here, and it moves forward in the same 5-prime to 3-prime direction until it catches up to the strand in front of it. The lagging strand catches up. And what happens at that point, as shown here, is that you get ligation of two strands as they come together. Okay? That's how you get the full complement of the strand being synthesized from the lagging strand template. Don't forget, the way the DNA polymerase works is that it requires the primer, an RNA primer, for DNA replication. And that's what these primase molecules are for. That's what these old cash marks are. That's the RNA primer that the DNA polymerase recognizes and starts going as serves as an anchor for the polymerization. Okay? Leading strand, lagging strand. That's what the excited fragments are. Good. Okay. Let's just talk about a couple other principles of molecular biology that you read about in the introduction. When I say Jacob, Minot, what do you think? Transmission?
Transformation.
I don't think transformation. Jacob, Minot, and Wolf. What do you think, when you say transformation, what do you think of?
Griffiths.
Griffiths, right. Principles of transformation and transporting principle, and that was done, what kind of bacteria? Strep, right? Streptococcus pneumonia, right? Transformation. Capsular and non-capsular, okay? That's transformation. While we're on it then, who discovered conjugation?
Lederberg
and Tate. Right. That was done in E. coli. Okay. How about transduction? Lederberg and Lederman. Right. Lederberg's in there again. Okay. Transduction is phage mediated gene transfer. Okay. So when we talk about Jacob Minot and Luff, those guys were involved in very basic fundamental concept of gene regulation of bacteria, which is the
operon.
Sounds like lac operon. Right. They did gene regulation. Okay? Nobel Prize for that. What about Arbor, Nathans and Smith? Dan Smith, Dan Nathans, Werner Arbor. Tryptophan? No. Tryptophan, the word name that comes to mind would probably be trillion ounce.
The restriction
enzyme. That's it. Nobel Prize. Discovery of restriction enzymes and the application of restriction enzymes for molecular biology. Also, Stanley Cohen and Doug Berg won Nobel Prizes for that. Interestingly enough, I don't think anybody coming into molecular biology these days appreciates the fact that Werner Arbor and Hans Smith are studying restriction enzymes because they're looking at bacteriophages. Werner Arbor is interested in bacteriophages. How did bacteriophages get into cells? Bacteria. How did bacteria defend themselves against bacteriophages? They did it by making enzymes which would destroy non-native DNA, restrict incoming DNA. And certain bacteriophages had enzymes which allowed them to destroy bacterial host DNA. So how does the phage protect its own DNA once it starts making those enzymes to destroy E. coli DNA? How many immunologists or aspiring immunologists here? It's the same principle.
Right?
Go ahead. Pardon? No, not Captain. No, eukaryotes. Forget about eukaryotes. Sorry, Michigan.
Are we getting
to
DNA or what?
The DNA. So, that's it. Methylation. Modification. Modification. So, restriction modification is really opening up the whole field of molecular biology, or at least a part of the whole field of molecular biology. Came out of studies looking at how bacteria defend themselves against phages and how phages utilize enzymes to destroy host bacterial DNA while protecting their own. And the way they do that is that they methylate the DNA so that you can distinguish self from non-self. It's like immunology, almost. Not really, but close. Okay, so now that we're in the whole modern era of molecular biology and talk about restriction enzymes, I got to ask you, do you all know how restriction enzymes work? Who doesn't? You all know. Andrew doesn't. Real quick description. Anybody?
A restriction endonuclease is an enzyme that recognizes a particular sequence on a DNA strand and it cuts the DNA at a certain point.
Right. Anybody want to add anything to that?
Sequence is palindromic.
Frequently, the most useful enzymes recognize palindromic sequences. Right. And what kinds of cuts do you get in the DNA?
Blunt ends or
sticky ends. What?
You get blunt ends or sticky ends.
Blunt end or sticky ends. Sticky ends are the same as overlapping single-stranded extensions. So what you end up with in the restriction digest or restriction cuts are asymmetric cuts. Now, there are enzymes that will recognize specific sequences and cut upstream or downstream of those sequences. Okay, so there are enzymes which behave differently. So we'll have a motif which will recognize the DNA sequence and cut somewhere else close by to that sequence, but not the actual recognition sequence. So there are sort of variations in this. So you need to know about restriction enzymes and how they work and how you use them, because otherwise you won't know how to do cloning. Because cloning works based on being able to get ends of DNA to ligate to each other, either because they have overlapping ends that can be annealed, right? Or you blunt end them together. Their enzymes, which of course blunt end is ligation as well. Okay. Southern hybridization. Who wants to describe it for me? Deborah, Melanie, Sue, Robert, trying to go in the news. Jessica, Tonya, Dawn, who did I miss? Diane. What's Andrew?
Southern blot is one where you're going to use to get set. Take your DNA, run it, purify out DNA. Put it on a put it through a membrane. Once you have your DNA bound to the membrane, you then have a radio labeled complementary probe. So if you're looking for a certain gene, for example, you know what you're looking for, you have a complementary probe. You then add the probe to the blot, and if your gene of interest is there, it'll bind. And then if it's radio labeled, you can look and see for the
for long time. Old school. Okay. Anybody want to add anything to that? Good description. Good start. Do you want to add anything to this? Anybody? Somebody? Basic concepts are, I'll use them. That's why I don't like these rooms that don't have the asymmetrically located screens that change the light. So Southern is DNA. Right? And basically what you're looking at is complementarity of sequences and annealing them so that they will line up to each other after you denature. So the process involves, as Diana said, running samples on a gel. You get your wells there and you get bands going through here. Depending on what kind of gel you're running. And then transferring basically the DNA that's in that gel matrix to a filter. And that's where all the basic calcium is. You can come by capillary action and you can speed it up by different processes. That's really important here. And what you do then is you denature the DNA in that filter. Okay, so basically the filter is going to look like a template of this. It's going to look like an image of this because you transfer the DNA from this matrix onto a filter. And all the processing is done on that filter so that you denature the DNA in place. DNA is immobilized in the filter, right? So it's going to be in place there it's going to look like this. You're not going to see anything yet, right? But what you've done here is you've treated it so that now you've separated the two strands of the DNA duplexes. Then you can block and then add your probe. And in each case, when we're talking about Southern or any of these other types of hybridization, you're going to have a probe, which is basically the marker that you're going to use to identify what you're looking for. So your probe is going to be, in this case, a particular gene or gene sequence, and you're going to look, use this probe to look for its homologue in the DNA going out in the gel. You're looking for homologous sequences where this probe, which is DNA, right, is going to be labeled with something so that you can now see where this goes and put on the probe. And where it's going to find its homologue is by renaturation to homologous DNA sequences. So the probe is going to be denatured too. And it's going to find its homologue in that gel. One DNA band in that gel. And the DNA can be labeled in a variety of ways. Diana was saying you can use 232. A lot of non-radioactive labeling techniques are available now so that when you add your probe to this and then develop it, whether by autoradiography or by luminescence with non-radioactive probes, what you're going to see is one or more of these bands lighting up. And if you've got a picture of the original gel, you can just refer back to that and find out which of these bands was now light up with your probe corresponding to the bands on the actual gel. Okay? So that's Southern hybridization. Why do you think they call it Southern? What do you guys think? That's Southern. So Northern hybridization is what? It's RNA. Basically the same principle as RNA. Why do you think they call it Northern?
Because the other one was Southern.
Because the other one was Southern. There's nothing fancy about that. And then you have Western. Why do you, what's Western? It's protein. It's basically protein binding, protein recognition. And what's the probe used for in Western hybridization? It's antibodies. Okay, so for Southern to Northern, it's nucleic acid based, RNA, DNA. Western is protein based, and Western just because it's the next point of counts. That's where we got that. Okay. Let's go ahead and move on and talk about the oxide stuff. The figures that are in the textbook, by the way, are really good figures. And I use them a lot in the, while I'm talking about my lectures, and other stuff we can use them too. Some of the figures I have are going to be in second edition because I didn't get the instructor's CD for the third edition, but basically they're the same. So this slide I'm putting up here because I want you to be sure that you understand how transcription translation works and what the nature of the gene is, all right? So for transcription initiation, what are the important elements in the DNA? I don't remember yet. Yeah. Ashley. Tell us what's important for transcription recognition, transcription initiation. Which promoter sequence? What defines a promoter sequence? Okay, so what is in that sequence that helps those factors to recognize it, to initiate the sequence?
Well, the transcript insert, I think XK has a terminal
lock. Okay. Yeah, the single factor is part of what machine?
Well, when RNA
comes. RNA comes. Right. Okay. So basically, what they're recognizing is the upstream sequences, the terminal box, also referred to as minus 2 minus 35 sequences. Basically, it's a stretch of the nucleic acid or the sequence in the DNA, which is, as Ashley said, more or less conserved, which is recognized by the RNA polymerase. And the RNA polymerase has different sigma factors also. So depending on the regulon or the genes which are being transcribed,
there may be different signal factors associated with RNA polymerase core enzyme. So that's why we speak of your classic RNA polymerase with the standard sigma factor, and then there also would be like sigma 28 regulated genes, which use the RNA polymerase core enzyme but with sigma 28 sigma factor, because it recognizes some sequences upstream of the minus 10 minus 35, which aids in the binding of that RNA polymerase upstream of those genes. So it's another layer of gene regulation where you have some specificity of the RNA polymerase sigma factor for these sequences. But the bottom line is that the transcription initiation in prokaryotes is going to be based on these upstream minus 10 minus 35 sequences. And the definition of the minus 10 minus 35 is relative to the first coding amino acid, the ATG start for the open reading. Okay? And this figure really shows you that you need to think of this transcription initiation not just as base pair to base pair interaction, but that the RNA polymerase actually is a large, spatially large molecule that's going to cover quite a bit of the DNA. So when we talk about protein DNA interactions, think about the size of these molecules as well and how much space they're actually going to cover. Okay? Now, what starts, it's got to end. So how do these things stop transcribing? And we're going to just restrict our discussion now to transcription initiation and termination. So one of the ways that they can terminate is what's called factor-independent termination. And what this involves is the RNA polymerase coming on and hitting a kink in the RNA, a hairpin loop, which will basically force the RNA polymerase to come off the template. And this doesn't require any other exogenous protein factors to dictate to the RNA polymerase that it's going to stop transcription at this point. So it's what happens as the DNA along the double-stranded duplex gets denatured, or gets unwound rather, by RNA polymerase, and where these hairpins can fold because of internal complementarity. That's what hairpins are. Yeah, I'm talking maybe jargon to some of you. Stop me if you don't understand it, but hairpin loops can form within a single strand of DNA because you have internal complementarity that you see here, okay? So you can get base pairing within a structure of DNA in a single strand. So it's internal to a single strand of DNA. So when you get this hairpin loop forming, that'll help the RNA polymerase to detach, okay? Now, there's another way that termination of transcription can occur, and that's the row-dependent form of transcription termination. So, who wants to describe that using this figure? I'm not even asking to draw anything.
So, row is a protein, and it'll bind to a specific site that it recognizes on the RNA that's been synthesized, and it'll cause the RNA to coil, and you'll sort of
we'll take from the top part here. So we have the RNA polymerase is going along and it's making the RNA. Mm-hmm. And then what is this here? That's a polymerase. What is that?
Ribosome.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, it's translating as it's being,
so that's what this
being
is.
Transcribed.
Okay, this is your polypeptide sequence, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's this what?
That's a sequence that it'll recognize on the RNA. Where the
row right. What? I think stands for row utilization and termination. Okay, so row is your
desired
set. What's row?
Oh, it's a protein that binds to the ref and.
Okay. Right. It binds to the ref.
Right. And yeah, it utilizes ATP.
Mm-hmm.
And it causes the RNA to coil. Is that an instant?
Okay, that's what you see there, right?
Yeah.
All right.
And that causes the dissociation of the polymerase from the DNA.
Okay. So why does this happen at all? Let's talk spatially and temporally here about what's going on. What do we know about prokaryotic transcription and translation?
It's
coupled. Right? It's coupled, meaning it goes on at the same time. So as soon as you get message being made, what happens? Ribosomes go on, they start translating. So what we see here is maybe not a function of the lack of space to put multiple ribosomes on here. What's going on here? Why do we only have this one ribosome? Something else is happening. Otherwise, this entire messenger RNA should be filled with ribosomes. What's going on at these row-dependent transcription or translation terminations? What's going on? And why should this what even be exposed? You just told me transcription and translation are coupled. And then RNA should be just covered with ribosomes.
Translation is hindered. Sorry, you have the stop put on. Has that
translated
on there?
Translation is hindered, right? The ribosomes are falling off. There is a pause. The RNA polymerase is rolling down here, and it gets to the termination site because now this what is exposed, but there are no more ribosomes coming along the message here to cover that rut. So the RNA polymerase is trying to move forward, and all of a sudden, with the rut site being open, Rho goes in there and coils the message. And basically, that's the signal to the RNA polymerase that it's time to terminate the transcription. So that's what's going on there. So the row-dependent or the factor-dependent termination is based on coupled translation along with the transcription. So while these ribosomes are going along here, they hit again that what's exposed, translation and transcription termination factor goes in and everything goes. Yeah.
So, as I understand properly, the rut acts as a terminator.
No, it doesn't include the stop. The stop would be before we get to the rut.
Okay, that's why the rut will fall.
Right. So the rut would be downstream of the translation termination site.
Yeah.
And this would be exposed because of translation termination for the rut system. Okay? So again, row-dependent, row-independent. And now let's move on to the local part of translation. In translation, your sequence for translation initiation is John Del Garno, right? So by analogy to your promoters, this is a sequence which is well conserved. You can generally predict where your translation initiation region is going to be based on the consensus with John Del Garno. And the Shine Del Garno is homologous to what? RNA, ribosomal RNA, exactly. So the 16S ribosomal RNA has sequences which are homologous to the Shine Del Garno, and it's by that interaction that translation can initiate. Okay? And your initiation codon is ATG, or in the messenger RNA, it's ATG. Now, there are some exceptions. Just be aware of that. There are some open reading frames that actually initiate translation with a codon other than the canonical methionine AUG. But they're not as frequent. So we don't need to go into any detail about that. Speaking of that, which, since you know, talking of science, there are always exceptions to the rules, and we like to have rules and principles and everything, but generally there are some exceptions that really make things a lot more interesting. So, for example, we'll talk about the genetic code. Yeah?
I don't fully understand what
Okay, we're going to talk about that in a minute. You know, I'm going to have somebody explain it. I thought I understood it when I found something new. Hesitate. Hold that question. What was I talking about?
Genetic
Who's
code.
Listening? Except on the rule. Thank you. Okay, so the genetic code is basically applicable to everybody. Actually, who are going to apply to this one? It applies to everybody, okay? So what's good for E. coli is good for elephants. Not that anybody here is an elephant, you understand. I'm just showing that it's worldly applicable, it's a universal code. But
where are there exceptions to the genetic code? Where doesn't it fit that little box that's in the inside of the book?
Mitochondria.
Mitochondria, right. Where else? There's some parasites also that kind of break the code. But yeah, mitochondria don't do it the same way. And there are some bacteria also that have tRNAs that recognize stop codons and put tryptophan in state. It's part of their normal makeup. Okay, so there are some exceptions to the rule, the most notable of which is in the mitochondria. Okay? Okay, open reading, please. In bacteria, since the first amino acid in the translation is that AUG, the thymine, bacteria put in not just any old methionine when they start translation protein, they put in an N-formulated methionine. So here's what methionine looks like. This is what your N-formulated methionine is. This is the amino acid which is used to charge special tRNAs that are used to initiate translation in bacteria. So that's why all of your bacteria start off with methionine. You start off with an N-formulated methionine, because that's the way bacteria go. It's the N-formulated methionine. Now, if you go in and actually look at proteins that the bacteria have made and do N-terminal sequence analysis, what do you think you're going to find at the end of every single protein in a bacterium? At the internal end. Gone.
Well, they cleave the formal group, right? So it's not, I don't know what you're asking, but like, what is at the beginning?
What are you going to find in any protein? So let's say you take any protein that out of bacteria from 2D geology, you do an internal sequence, what do you expect to find at the internal end?
So the N-terminus of the binding?
Like
well, actually, it said that they cleave, it actually cleaves sometimes the binding off.
That's right. So even though they all put on and form the binding, not all the proteins that are finally made after the processing contain the binding. And none of them have the formal group on the binding if they do have the binding at the end. So what's happening to the formal group? Dawn?
It's getting cleaved by some enzyme.
So
it's called the methionine aminopeptidase.
Methionine aminopeptidase, or the formalates. Yeah, the language of biochemistry actually is really pretty pure too, because as long as you understand everything that ends in an ASE is an enzyme, that's all you know that biochemistry. No, that's not true. But it helps you understand biochemistry. So it's a formalate. Now, the reason why bacteria put on N-form methionine at the beginning of every protein is not really understood, I don't think. If anybody can explain it to me, I'm open to ideas. But let me ask you, just hypothetically, what do you think would be the consequences of making a mutation in that enzyme that Dawn just told us? Hormones. So I said, we know where the gene is, it's the deaf gene, right? It's not. Well, makes sense, yeah. Deformulates, right, yeah, that's it. So if you made a knockout mutation in the formulation, so that it doesn't have the ability to then flip off this formal group, what do you think is going to happen to that bacteria? The protein? Okay. Usual. It's not good for the bacteria. In fact, this is an essential enzyme for bacteria.
Most bacteria proteins after
the formal group is kicked off all the protein. Okay, now I'm going to tell you to keep that in mind because I'm going to have you work out something later on. I'm going to have you work it out. You guys up for a problem for the next class? Okay, so. If you understand then that you make a mutation in this formalase, and bacteria don't survive,
right? So it's an essential gene. Okay, right here. So I'm going to tell you that I can make a mutant E. coli that doesn't make the formulase and is perfectly viable on this. Okay? Think about that. So you already know the experiment is that all evidence indicates that if you eliminate the ability of this bacterium to deformulate, to remove the formal group from the N-terminal N-formal methionine, that bacteria cannot survive. And I'm telling you, I can make a bacterium that can. Pardon? I'm going to ask you to do it right now. Just food for thought for Thursday, okay? We come up with it on Thursday. Come up with it today. Write it down. Here's the number. All right? Think about it. Now you can make a bacterium that can live without that. Okay, what is an ORF? It's an open reading frame. Okay? Thank you, Dawn. So what's an open reading frame?
Yeah, I understand. There's just, I mean, there's no stop codons. I don't know what how to formally define it, but when you look at it, like when you're doing sequencing, mm-hmm. and they give you the three different frames that it could potentially be in,
right?
There's usually like two of them are just filled with a whole bunch of stop codons. So the open reading frame, I don't know, it just doesn't have any of those stop codons in it.
Okay, if I want to modify actually define the definition, it. Refine it. It's a good start.
Yeah, okay, that's good.
So this is from the start codon to the end codon. So, yeah, Dawn got it right. And actually, Dawn's definition leads into the next question, which is, I don't know your name, Dawn. Ashley, no, you're Ashley. They'll tell me. You're Melanie, right? Yeah. So you're not Melanie. You're not Melanie. I can't wait to take it. What? I did? So your definition is that an open reading frame is from the ATG start to the termination code, the stop code. That's your learning. Right? That's good. That's your definition. Now, the question I want to ask you is, and this gets back to Dawn's description, how do you know that that's a learning? Because based on Dawn's description, anything that starts with an ATG and ends with a stop code on is a learning. And Sora, you're shaking your head. Oh, sorry, you're falling asleep. No, you're shaking your head. You don't agree, right? Anything that starts with an ATG and stops with stop codon is never reading. Yes or no?
Yes.
No, I can't be that same. Can't say no. No one is saying no. Okay, so now we're adding some other criteria, right? There should be something in front of that ATG that indicates that this is actually a gene that's being transcribed, right? First of all, that's being transcribed. All right, let's add something else to it now. What else would you like to see if you define over the reading frame? Get back to my original question. How big does it have to be? Is there a minimum number of amino acids in that stretch before it goes out of frame and gets a stop codon? You know? Okay, Dawn, you started with sequence analysis, right? Mm-hmm. Sequence analysis programs have cutoffs. They'll put minimums in there. They'll say, don't give me anything that's smaller than X amino acids. I'm not going to call it an open reading frame unless it has at least 75 amino acids, 100 amino acids. You can put limits on it. Because you can look at any stretch of DNA, you can find an ATG, and you can find a stop, there could be 5 amino acids. Is that an open reading frame? Well, based on the original definition, it would. But you put these other criteria in there. So there's got to be a size limitation, okay, which we may be wrong. Maybe we're making it too large a minimum. Maybe the minimum can be much smaller, right? So that's one. Looking for promoter starts. That's another one, right? What other criteria would you like to see in there in order to define a career? Anything else? Let's look at these sequences here. This is an alignment that's done with homologs that are found in different strains of Shigella and enteropathogenic, enterohemorrhagic, colonizing citrograph. And the alignment is really, really nice, with the exception that at the boxy terminal end of these two strains, it stops before these other guys stop. And what do you think that's caused by? What happened? Otherwise, they're practically identical to all these others, which go all the way out to greater than 230 amino acids. What do you think happens to the flux for divergence?
Mutation,
right? It's a frame shift here. Actually, a frame shift knocks it out of frame. You can tell here because everything is the same until it gets to this, is that band in there, lead, and a tyrosine. And they're not the same as the rest of these guys, which are relatively highly conserved. So what you have is a frame shift here that knocks it out of frame and puts in a valine tyrosine instead of serine or leucine, and then it's a stop for them, and nothing else can happen, right? So it's terminally immature. In fact, you can confirm that by looking at the DNA sequence, and what would you expect to see? Here would be a frame shift, right? Base pair insertion and deletion in this case. What about the rest of the DNA sequence down this way? You put it back in the frame, you get the exact same amino acid sequence. Okay? So that confirmed what you suspected was going on. But that's not the end I want to talk about. Maybe this one. Why is all dysenteriae different than these other guys? Why would you think they would have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 extra amino acids at the end of the room? Hey, you down. You have not class.
It starts, there's a methionine as the first one, so it started reading. The promoter sequence came before that first methionine.
You think?
That's my guess.
Yeah. Okay. What you got here is what the genome annotators gave you as what they think is the reading. It is based on what Dawn told us. Where is the methionine start here? Well, what happens when you have multiple methionines? Where do you start? And in every one of these cases, they started here, and as you got these dysenteriae, they looked up here and said, oh, there's a methionine up there. So we're going to call the start here instead. So how do you know whether this methionine is the authentic start codon for translation of this protein, or this methionine, where the other eight protein annotators call the start of that opening? I need to distinguish between those two possibilities, because right now the Shigella dysenteriae group is saying it actually starts here. Everyone else is saying it starts here. How do we know where the authentic start is? Now, not based on what we talked about, where the formal group is pretty thought by the formal group, right? So that's not going to be helpful.
Can you go back to the DNA sequence?
Oh, the DNA sequence is what gave us this information. If you go at the RNA, what are you going to see? Because there is an upstream untranslated region, right? So that's not going to be too informative. It includes all of this.
Express both proteins and see if both of them are functional. And if they're both functional, then you probably don't need this first.
Well, right, the question is, how do we know if the protein is being made from here or from here?
Can you sequence the protein?
Can you sequence the protein? Okay, so you express the protein, isolate the protein, and sequence the N-terminal. N-terminal sequencing is relatively straightforward and not too expensive now. So you can ask the question, what is the authentic N-terminal sequence of this protein in the homologs and the other systems? Does it in fact start here, where the dysenteriae sequence is predicted to start, or here? I might add parenthetically that all these other Shigella strains, if you look upstream of that methionine that they said here, is the sequence start. You look upstream, if you translated those upstream pieces, the upstream structure DNA, you get this exact same sequence.
So they saw basically the same sequence of DNA. They just chose this methionine as the spot methionine, not this one. So again, annotations. Take them with a grain of salt, look at your DNA. Because you're going to see anomalies like this where you can't be really sure now which is the authentic start. Because the promoter start site hasn't been sequenced or identified. And the internal sequence of these proteins hasn't been determined either. So we don't know which one's the true. And just isolating the proteins and looking for activity doesn't help because it doesn't tell you where the protein actually start. You have to actually look at the protein sequence itself. Because the DNA sequence will predict either or, because you have two methionines which are not too far apart. All right? So that's just a cautionary note when you're looking at sequences and annotations. And believe me, you'll be doing a lot of basically, those annotations are done by computers using algorithms which are based on the experience of many, many years of looking at and decoding sequences. But you'll get some anomalies like this, which you're going to have to go in by hand and sort out, and then do experimentally to determine the resolution of questions like this. Okay? So that answer your question about open reading frames? It's pretty simple, but actually when you think about it, it's a little more complicated because you have to look for more than just ATG to a stock code. All these other things need to be taken into consideration. Okay. Any questions on the introductory material? Yes.
Figure 2.9. Was it figure 2.9? I have my book open to figure 2.9 and I didn't see the same figure.
Versus the slides I showed you?
Yeah.
Yeah, what I said was that the slides that I'm going to use, that I use today and I'm going to be using for subsequent lectures comes from the second edition. Because I haven't yet received the CD that has the figures from the third edition. So some of the slides will be the same. Some of the slides are a little bit more enhanced than the third edition. And in some chapters, the slides will have the same figure numbers because they inserted new slides and new figures. But basically, it's still the same material. So don't be confused if what you see doesn't match up with what's in the book. There'll be a figure in the book which is a fancier version of what I found in my slide. Okay? Anything else? Okay, we'll see you on Thursday. Have a question? Okay, you did. Yeah, sorry. Row dependent, row independent. There are certain genes which have row dependent stop signals and some which don't. I don't think that there's any real reason. Why certain genes happen, why certain genes don't. I don't know whether there really is a reason for that. Or how they evolved to happen or not. There are, I don't know that there are any other mechanisms for transcription formation.
For the introduction to research class, you're scheduled to speak next Wednesday?
Yeah. I had an email exchange with Jeff Harmon about this. For those of you who are an MCV, this is for you. The EID students doesn't involve you. The same thing which I gave to the EID students, I'm going to do with the MCV students in terms of talking about research programs, research projects for their rotations. We're supposed to be doing it next Wednesday, since it's the day before Thanksgiving. Sharon Giuliano and I, in conjunction with Jeff Harmon, we decided we're going to postpone that. Because some people are going to be leaving early to go out of town. We'll do ours in February. We'll just reschedule it. So we won't be doing it next Wednesday at 11:30. Okay?
Thank you.